The problem with delegation is everyone starts with it. You notice we didn't start with it. We started with dreams, to visions, to goal setting, to time management, to communication. We've hired the right people and fired the wrong ones, gotten the right people on the bus, the wrong people off the bus. We're creating an atmosphere, a changed organization with unity and loyalty. We're not dealing with gossip, and we don't have unresolved disagreements. You do all of that in order to create an atmosphere where you can delegate. When you try to delegate and all of those other things aren't done, you're going to run into the wall. Somebody's going to punch you in the face. I mean, you're going to have a problem.
Welcome to Dave Ramsey's Entree Leadership Podcast. This is the place to learn what Dave Ramsey and his team teach about leadership and business. My name is Chris Hogan, and I'm excited to host another great episode for you today. Today on the podcast, we have Robert Kaplan. After a 22-year career at Goldman Sachs, Robert Stephen Kaplan left his position as vice chairman of the firm in 2005 to teach at Harvard Business School, where he is now professor of management practice and senior associate dean. We're so excited to have him on the podcast today to talk about his new book, What You're Really Meant to Do, A Roadmap for Reaching Your Unique Potential. Please welcome to the podcast, Robert Kaplan. Robert, how are you?
How are you? Thanks for having me, Chris.
Absolutely fantastic. Excited to be able to talk with you and pick your brain.
All right.
Now, one of the things that stood out to me in your book was you really talk about the importance of knowing your story. Why do we need to know our own story?
The reason for knowing our own story or being more aware of our own story is so we can figure out why we do what we do. Hmm. So how many times you've been in a situation where you're in a confrontational situation or you're under a pressure situation, and after you just say, oh, wish I'd handle that differently. Why did I do that? Why did I lose my cool? Why didn't I speak up? And beneath all that is your life story, experiences in your life, traumas maybe in your life, relationship with your parents, times where you may have even been fired, had a bad experience with a coach. And what I'm trying to get people to do is not forget those memories, but be more aware of them and realize that when you get into a situation now and in the future, help you explain why you might react the way you do and maybe manage your behavior better.
Okay. So the awareness of those issues give us the control, I guess, to manage them a little bit better.
A little bit better. And in particular for me, I mean, I was in a high-stress business for many years. I used to try to be aware of what creates stress for me. You know, a lot of money's at stake. People's lives are at stake. And I need to keep my cool. So I used to do this, and I encourage my people, think about what freaks you out, what stresses you out, because you're going to be stressed out here, and you're going to need to learn how to deal with it. So you got to understand how you react to these things.
Interesting. So if I know what stresses me out or freaks me out, what do I do with it then? What would be one of your suggestions?
So then the question is, okay, so how do I deal with it? And that's tougher. And that's why I talk about in the book where you have people you have relationships with or coaches at work or wherever you are, where you go to them and say, you know, I struggled to confront people. I struggled to keep my cool in certain situations or something like that. And they may say, well, you know what, try this. Or I had the same problem. You know what I learned to do? Try this or try that. And see, once you talk to people about it and get a little advice, what you find is you're not the only one. Everybody is struggling with these kinds of issues. And what happens is they've developed techniques for how to deal with them. And, you know, you can learn a lot from people, but only if you talk about it and you ask.
That's exactly right. So your suggestion is obviously don't go it alone.
No. Why do people fail? And I say this all the time. Most of us think people don't fail because they're not smart enough or they don't get the breaks. And that may be partially true, but the biggest reason is isolation and inability to learn. You're isolated because you don't ask for help or you don't talk to others and you don't keep learning. And people don't realize, some people think when you get in certain jobs you need to act like you have all the answers, and I don't think that at all. You got to learn for the rest of your life And great leaders, people who reach their potential, realize I've got to keep learning and I've got to work to avoid being isolated.
Wow. Now, because in American culture, when you reach out and ask for help, you're made to look weak if you do that.
Exactly. The perception is, or the stereotype is, you know, the strong, silent type, the lonely, you know, it's lonely at the top, a kind of leader who keeps cards close to his or her vest.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've learned by being a leader myself and working with many, many successful leaders is the great ones actually are very willing to ask a question, seek advice. They're confident enough to not be afraid about looking weak because they know that they won't. They know that if you seek advice from someone or you admit when you made a mistake, that actually makes you look strong and not weak. And yet the conventional wisdom is, boy, don't admit a mistake. You'll look like a weakling. I don't think so. I think the great leaders learn that you've got to learn to do that, and you've got to be open, because otherwise you're going to be isolated a lot of the time, and you're going to fail to learn, and you're going to make a lot of mistakes.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, as a leader, you're already out front and a little bit isolated. So I love your advice. You know, ask for help when you need it, and don't continue to put yourself further out on an island.
Yeah. And the one thing for the entrepreneurs out there, the people that are the head of their own business, and they know what I'm about to say, you are by definition isolated. Your people are a little bit afraid of you. You sign all the checks. You're the king or queen of the business. And so they're a little bit afraid to come talk to you or bring you bad news that you need to hear. And so the power disparity is great. And as a leader, you've got to learn that the power, you have a lot of power, that can be a good thing, but all that power can be a bad thing because it makes people afraid to tell you what's really going on, and you need to hear that in order to improve the business.
Yes. Well, tell us a little bit of your story. How did you get from a successful career on Wall Street to Harvard?
Well, it was definitely not something I planned. It was, you know, I loved my career at Goldman. I loved the markets. I've been watching the markets every day since I was 10 or 11 years old. My father was a jewelry salesman in the Midwest, but he taught me about the markets. And so what happened was I was responsible ultimately for all the client businesses at my firm at Goldman Sachs. And the industry, not just Goldman, but the industry was getting more and more dominated by trading, less client-oriented. And I started to feel like maybe it was time for me to do something else, in that the direction of the street was a little less exciting to me than what it was. So I sort of searched for what to do, and I came up with a compromise where I took a leave of absence for 3 months with the agreement of my boss, who at the time was Hank Paulson. And I kept my office at the firm, and I went and taught leadership for 3 months at Harvard, thinking I would come back to the firm. And after I was gone for 3 months, I realized, if there was ever a time I'm going to be able to have the fortitude to leave Wall Street, because it's hard to do, and to leave my job, this is it. And I didn't know if I would keep teaching for all these years, but I realized that maybe I could add more value doing something else in my life, that I could make a bigger impact than what I was making by moving to another area. And this has turned out to be it. And it's been dramatic retooling and dramatic change and a lot of hard work to retool, but it's given me a chance to make a greater impact in a different way.
Wow. So you really had to retool your expectations and goals.
Completely. I mean, when you get to be a senior person at a Wall Street firm, it's not that you don't do anything yourself, but basically you've got help with everything you do.
Hmm.
And I had to shift, where as a professor, you've got to do basically everything yourself. Prepare for class, teach the class, grade papers, do whatever. And when you write a case or write a book, that's you. You can't delegate that.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly, when I first got to Harvard, I sat on a Monday morning in early August trying to get ready to teach a month later, and I read a 14-page case, and it occurred to me that I couldn't understand it. I realized it had been 20-plus years since I had sat down and read something and really had to comprehend it. And I always had help doing it. I had to do this by myself. And I realized I had to defrost my brain. And it took me a while to learn to do the things I needed to do.
Let me ask you this. I know it had to take courage for you to go in to tell Hank you were done.
Yes, it did. And he's not an easy guy to have that conversation with. And it wasn't one conversation. It was probably five or six where, you know, the first three times it was, please leave my office and don't come back in here again. And then, you know, and then we just talked and talked and talked. But, yeah, it did. It took a lot. And the only thing that made it easier is I was aware that most Wall Street careers are going to end eventually, you know, at a big firm. You're going to, if worse comes to worse, I'm not going to work beyond my 60s. There are almost no 65-year-olds there at the firm. And so I realized I got to leave eventually. And so the only thing that made me feel better is, why not leave while I'm young enough to retool and start a new career that I could do for the next 30 years?
Interesting.
But it was traumatic. It was hard. And it was really hard.
Did you ask for help as you were going through that transition from friends?
I did, actually. And I went with I actually talked at length to a friend of mine who had been to Harvard Business School with me and had then become a psychiatrist. And I actually, I won't mention his name on the air because he'll strangle me, but for doing it, but we had several conversations, and he helped me get mentally prepared that this was going to be a very difficult thing to voluntarily do.
Hmm.
And I needed that help.
Yes.
Because everybody else in my life, friends, family, thought it was a terrible idea, naturally, because they thought, how can you give up this position? You just don't give up a position like this.
What did you tell them?
I told them I just have an instinct that I just don't have the passion for it. And I talk about this in the book. Passion is the rocket fuel that allows you to excel. Mm-hmm. And I started to feel like I was performing what seemed like at a high, very high level to others, but to me was not the high level that I really expected of myself. And so I explained to him, listen, I'm not operating at a high enough level of impact, positive impact, to justify me staying in this job. It's not right for the firm, it's not right for me, and I think I've got to rejigger while I'm young enough and do something that I have the same level of passion for that I have for the previous 22 years at Goldman Sachs.
Wow. Now, in the book, you talk about the difference between being successful and reaching your potential.
Yes.
If you can, tell us a little bit more about what you mean with that.
Well, a classic case is what we were just talking about. I was successful at Goldman Sachs, meaning title, status, money, power, all the visual metrics of achievement. And I felt good about it, but mm-hmm. I don't know if I was reaching my potential. Reaching potential means creating your own definition of success, not metrics established by others, but your own definition of success. That could be a successful parent. It could be helping other people. It could be making a positive impact on others and on the world. It can be whatever you define it as. It doesn't need to be money, status, title, or power. It does not. And the reason I make this distinction is there's a lot of people out there who have money, title, status, and power, and they come see me regularly, and they are very unhappy. And when they first started, it was disturbing. I couldn't figure out why. And then I started to realize because their definition of success was broader, and they weren't meeting their own definition of success. And so the key is you can take what other people and your friends and family and society thinks is cool, but you've got to ultimately put a stake in the ground for what you believe is cool and what you feel good about and create your own definition. And then you've got to work toward that, and that's what it means to me to reach your potential.
I like that. I mean, because the last thing you want to do is look up 15 years down the road and you're living someone else's dream.
Absolutely. Now, the tricky part about reaching your potential is when you achieve certain metrics, you've made it.
Mm-hmm.
No getting back. You make partner or you make a certain amount of money and you've arrived. Reaching your potential, unfortunately, you never arrive.
Hmm.
It is a moving target for the rest of your life. Because you're changing, the world's changing, there's new accomplishments, there's new mountains to climb. And so I think reaching your potential is harder, but I do believe much more satisfying. But it's harder because it's never a destination you make it to. It's like getting in shape or losing weight. you would never say, oh, I've lost 20 pounds, now I can eat anything I want.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm now in shape and I'll stop exercising. I never need to exercise again. And reaching your potential is the same way. You got to work at it.
Wow. I like that. And so having that awareness to where you do, you continue to set up and strive to reach that destination you never make it to. That is very good. Now, if you would unpack kind of the intrinsic versus extrinsic motivators that you talk about in the book?
Yes. So, you know, people may say from this book, gee, I'm saying you shouldn't be motivated by money. Now, money is an extrinsic motivator. These are the visible manifestations of quote-unquote success. And money, title, power, influence, things that you can see that when I go into a cocktail party, I can tell people about, and they say, oh, man, that's really, your professor at Harvard is really cool. And whether you're happy or not is another matter.
Mm-hmm.
But those are the extrinsic motivators. And a lot of people get a big, for a good reason, get a big thrill out of that. The intrinsic motivators are the daily motivators that maybe no one sees but appeal to you. So examples, I work with interesting people. The subject matter is interesting. I believe in the mission. I'm fascinated by the work. I think it's just so interesting. I never get tired of it. And what I say to people is one is not better than the other. Extrinsic are not worse than intrinsic, but people need to be aware if the reason you're doing something is all extrinsic, my experience is you're never going to achieve those things because you're going to run out of gas before you get there. Extrinsic motivators tend to be long-term or back-end oriented.
Mm.
They come as a result of years and years and years of high performance. And my own experience and belief is, and I've seen this consistently, you need the intrinsic motivators along the way so that you can sustain and perform at a high level so you can eventually achieve the extrinsic motivators.
Wow.
And what people get confused about is they go for a job that, yeah, I'm going to take the job where I make the money. And you got to caution them, you got to enjoy one or two or three key elements of the job, or you're never going to make the money, because you even in lucrative jobs, you won't be there long enough to make the money. And so that's what I'm trying to help people think through so that they don't realize after 3 years, oh, my God, why did I choose that profession? Now I got to start over.
Mm-hmm. And I can actually, Robert, remember a mentor of mine when I was in college of giving me kind of that advice.
Yes. And where young people get confused is they get, well, are you saying it's one or the other? And you're saying, no, it's not one or the other. You just make sure you don't forget the intrinsic ones.
Now, you also mentioned in chapter one the rules of the road,
yes.
Five rules of the road. And if you would, can you talk us through those?
Yes. So let me go through them. And I'll do them concisely, because what they are, they're about your mindset. So I'm going to take a trip. It's going to be a long trip. There's going to be lots of winds in the road. It's a lifelong effort. So if you're going to take that trip, you need the right mindset. If I think I'm going on a sprint that's going to last a few days, I got one mindset. And if I think I'm going to go on a 40-year journey, you need a different mindset. And so what I'm trying to say in this first chapter is, this is going to be a long journey. It's going to last the rest of your life. So examples of some of these rules of the road are, act like an owner. A lot of us go through life at many times feeling like victims.
Mm.
I work at this big company. I didn't get promoted. Or they asked somebody else to do a job that I wanted. And why did this happen to me? And the reality is, I say to people, if you're going to take this trip, you've got to own knowing your strengths and weaknesses, and speaking up about what jobs you're interested in, and speaking up so that if someone's going to consider you for promotion, you've said what you wanted, and you've worked on owning the skills you need to develop to get there. So that's one, is act like an owner. Another one is beware of conventional wisdom, meaning it's what we talked about before. There's always what the smart people know is the thing to do if you want to get ahead. You know, it's smart not to speak up at work because it's just you're gonna get in trouble. That could be a conventional wisdom.
Okay.
You know, it takes connections to get ahead. There's all the conventional wisdom stuff, or everybody knows if you get offered a lucrative job, you should take it. And the truth is, conventional wisdom is almost always wrong, particularly for you.
Hmm.
So, Conventional wisdom 35 years ago is it was a great career to be a doctor, medical doctor, and it was prestigious, and a lot of people went into it even though they didn't have a passion for it. But conventional wisdom was this was a cool thing to do. And who knew that the world would change so dramatically where it's, if you love seeing patients, it's still the best job in the world, but if you did it for other reasons, you probably regret it. So beware of conventional wisdom. It's a shortcut to understanding yourself. Conventional wisdom is what everybody else thinks you should do, and reaching your potential means you got to do the harder job of actually owning and understanding yourself. And I'll give one other, assume that justice will prevail, which means even though justice will likely not prevail at any one point in time, I may get passed over for promotion, I may not get the compensation I deserved, I may be unfairly judged. Don't let that cause you to sabotage the way you behave. So I've seen people who didn't get promoted decide, I'm not going to cooperate with other people now. Mm-hmm. Or I'm not going to help other people because see where it got me?
Mm-hmm.
It just backfired. Or I'm not going to be open with people and seek help because I think they'll use it against me because that was I didn't get promoted and that I think that's what happened. And I've seen many people take a setback and then feel the world is an unfair place, and they wind up sabotaging their own performance in the longer term. And so even though you've got to be prepared that injustice will happen to you, but don't let it get you off the idea that justice will prevail. And listen, to reach your potential does require a bit of a leap of faith that you do need to make. So those are three examples of rules of the road. There are a couple of others, but the whole idea is your mindset, because you're going to have a lot of bumps and bruises along the way, and what's your mindset in dealing with it?
Hmm. Well, so what are some of the best ways to identify your strengths and weaknesses?
Well, first, I sort of go through two or three steps. Step number one is try to write them down.
Okay?
And all of us can do that, and then when you get to the weaknesses, invariably, you hate to write down what the real ones are. So you write down euphemistic ones like, you know, I'm impatient. You know, I'm very impatient. I hear that almost always when I ask somebody their weaknesses. But this is for you. Write down the real weaknesses. Now, step two is you're going to have to then go to someone who directly observes you, not a mentor who you talk to about your performance, but somebody who sees you every day.
Mm.
Because the problem with mentors is you can tell them a story and they give you feedback, but we all have blind spots, so there's always a hole in our story. And what instead I prefer is talk to people who see you every day. Believe me, they know your weaknesses. And believe me, they don't need to think for very long to come up with them.
Now, that's going to hurt. That's going to get me mad, Robert.
It might. So here's the problem. So then this gets the complicated part. Take that little list,
okay,
and you sit down with them and you say, can you give me some advice on one or two areas that I need to improve on?
Mm.
Now, a lot of people won't want to answer, or they'll be afraid to answer because they don't want to offend you. So this is where you need relationships. And I write a whole chapter in this book about relationships. You need to develop, cultivate a few people who know you're sincere and are going to tell you the truth, you know, the brutal truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I have found in my experience it's the only way for me to get at my real weaknesses. And this is true on written skills and speaking skills, but I found the most successful people have a knack for being able to get feedback from others, even though it kind of hurts,
mm-hmm,
or does hurt. So that's step two. And then the third step is to decide what to do. So a lot of people think, oh, I've got a weakness, I've got to improve on it. Nah, not necessarily. There are certain weaknesses it's not realistic to improve on. There's other weaknesses you can address by surrounding yourself with other people who have complementary skills, or, yes, by actually trying to do some things to improve. But this is where tactics get involved. Just because you have a weakness doesn't mean you need to improve on it. This is all about awareness.
Mm-hmm.
It means you need to either surround yourself with the right people or pick and choose which skills you need to improve on. And we see presidents of the United States, for example, or other senior leaders around the world in business and government, the best ones know how to surround themselves with people with complementary skills, and it really serves them well. And the ones that are unaware and don't actually go through these strengths and weaknesses accurately may find that in a crisis, they really, in their team, are at a loss to deal with the crisis because they don't have the right team given their strengths and weaknesses.
Interesting. And you said something that I'd really love for you to unpack a little bit more. You said some weaknesses may need to be ignored.
Yeah, exactly. So here's an example. And the one, I'll give an exaggeration to make a point. I'm a very fast runner. Okay, I was always the fastest kid in my high school. And so you'd say that's a strength, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if I wanted to try out for the Olympics, though, that strength is now a weakness. Because I'm slow, actually, relative to a world-class sprinter.
Okay.
Okay, so what do? I got two things I could do. And I would put analytical skills or quantitative skills in this. There are certain skills where you can work and work and work and work. You may well be unlikely to dramatically improve them.
Okay.
Here's my foot speed. I could do speed training, and I will improve my speed, but it will never be good enough to be a world-class sprinter. Okay, so why bother? Let's say I'm not all that quantitative. I think it may be hard to make a person who hates numbers and is not quantitative. You're not going to transform them, but it could be as simple as they hire a person who has got great quantitative skills and problem solved. It's not a good use of that leader's time or your time to try to fix a skill that's unrealistic to fix.
Okay.
Now, it may be that I choose a different job. It may be I surround myself with certain people. It may be I realize that I can do the job at a high level of performance, and I'll focus on my strengths and realize that I'm going to have to delegate my weaknesses to other people. But what I don't want to do is masquerade around and act like I'm good at something that I'm not good at, or try to do something I'm not good at because I feel I got to show I can do it. And a lot of leaders never figure this out because they're not willing to be self-aware about what they're good at and what they're not good at, because they think if they're in charge, they need to be Superman or woman.
Well, and especially with a small business owner, you know,
yeah,
someone that has 10 to 12 team members or whatever, and they do have to wear a lot of hats, but just because you're wearing a hat doesn't mean you can't share that hat with somebody with experience.
Absolutely. And I can give you a very quick example. I had the heads of a decorating firm in a large city come to me, and they happened to be in town, and they said, you know, we're having a terrible problem in our business. And they were friends of a mutual friend, so I talked to them. And they're great decorators. They have got a big business, but both of them are weak at logistics, and they're not very organized, either of them, even though they're great decorators, very creative. Turns out that one of the key tasks that you need to be great at, and I talk about this in the book, you need to identify the key tasks that you need to be great at in your job.
Okay.
You need to then match that to your strengths and weaknesses and figure out the mismatch.
Hmm.
Then you need to figure out strategy. In their case, they're never going to be good with logistics and ordering from vendors. And they tell me about all the horror stories, what happened in their business, because they screwed up so many orders, because the way they organize their firm, every decorator, including the two of them, does all their own ordering with the vendors.
Gotcha.
And so all we decided was in that meeting, fine, just designate a person in your firm who does all the logistics, and you guys should only spend your time on the creative and
mm-hmm.
working with clients. And as ridiculously simple as that sounds, they hadn't thought of that. They went back and did it, and life is dramatically better now.
Hmm.
But that's a good example of not being willing to acknowledge we're no good at this, and we want to address it.
Well, and it also goes back, Robert, to what you said, which is stay open to feedback. And stay aware to ask for help, because I can tell you this, if those two decorators hadn't come to you and hadn't asked you, they never would have heard that. And there's no telling what that business, how fast it might have gone under.
You're right. And the only reason they had come to see me is they were getting so many complaints from clients, and they had to personally make those mistakes whole. They were starting to hate the business.
Now, also in the book, you have another statement that I'd love for you to unpack a little bit. You say in the book, we're not at our best if we're not doing what we're good at, or if we're not doing what we're meant to do.
So what you're meant to do ideally needs to fit with your strengths and weaknesses and your passions.
Okay.
Okay. So the trick in it, which is always a hard thing to do, is to understand your strengths and weaknesses and your passions and your own story. You know, what makes you tick, and then try to match that to jobs out there,
okay,
or an industry or a task or a role where you can add value. And what I say in the book is, if there's a mismatch or severe mismatch, and particularly in the area of passion, if you don't have a passion for what you're doing, it's going to be hard to reach your potential. And so there's always a little bit of a mismatch, because industries are always changing, we're always changing, competitors are changing, everything is changing. So you're always having to reassess and rejigger and rejudge.
Yeah, well, now, in chapter four, you talk about a story of the chef.
Yes.
And you, if you're talking about kind of reconfiguring and staying in touch, his story was profound.
Yes.
In my opinion. Can you tell us a little bit about the chef and what he was battling?
So he was a classic case where he used to run a restaurant, and he really, he loved it. He loved everything about it. Then he got to be running a bigger business. He opened up new locations. I think there was a little bit in the story about, you know, part of it was he wanted to prove something, that he could run a bigger business. And what he found was the tasks of a running a chain are different than the tasks of running a restaurant. And he hadn't really thought that through, and he found that the big things that the job required, he did not enjoy at all.
Mm-hmm.
He had not really then gone through systematically. He knew viscerally that there was a mismatch, but systematically, his strengths and weaknesses and his passions no longer matched the job. So his reaction was, I'm not even sure I want to do this anymore. And the better answer would be to do the analysis and figure out if there's a way to delegate some of the things he didn't enjoy and build a team and coach others so he could then run a chain and still focus on the things that he loved. There were still more things only he could do,
mm-hmm,
which maybe he didn't love, but it didn't need to be the dominant part of his job. And that was just a matter of just slowing him down and unpacking, as you say, all the elements of what was bothering him. And once he did that, he was able to put it back together and simply make a few, not huge adjustments, but adjustments in the composition of his team. And he realized, you know, he didn't need to do everything himself. And this is the problem with leadership. Nobody defines what a leader does, and everybody has a different conception of it. And a lot of people, particularly entrepreneurs, mistakenly think, my father did everything himself when he ran the business, so I must do what he did. That's a classic one.
That is.
And the truth is, no. You're not the same as your father. He had different strengths and weaknesses than you. You've got to adapt your skills and your approach to this and do it in a way that fits you.
I really like that. And I like how you are always making people look inward so they can grow outward. And you talk about that with the narratives. You talked a little bit about understanding your own. Those are the things that make you click. But you also point out that the failure narrative is probably just as important as the success narrative.
Yes.
Why?
So this is one, when I talk to people about this, this winds up getting a lot of laughter, because nervous laughter, because people all realize how true it is for them. So all of us have, we have three stories. There are the facts, which, you know, just the facts, where I was born, where I went to school, what dates, you know, what your parents did, et cetera. Then there's a second story, which we're all very good at, which you refer to it as the success story. That's the story I tell in a job interview, when I go to a cocktail party, when I'm trying to make a good impression, when I go on television, where you do my bio before you interviewed me today. And boy, it's a beautiful story. He went to this, and then he went to that, and it was, success after success after success, and there may be setbacks in that success story, but always ends up the same with you as the hero. Okay. So, and that one I always joke around with people, we don't need to practice that story because you've got so much practice telling that one, I don't need to give you any more practice. Okay, so then there's the third story. This is the one I'm interested in. This is the story you're not telling. You're not telling to anybody, maybe. And this is the failure story. And we all have one. I certainly do. All of us do. This is the story where I remember how I, you know, tried out for the, you know, baseball team and didn't make it, or I screwed up at work, or I had some other bad experience that was traumatic. And I decided as a result of that, I can't do something. I'm scared. I'm no good at this. I will never do blank. And the problem with failure narratives is it's usually not politically correct to wear those on our sleeve because we want to make a good impression.
Mm-hmm.
But they affect our behavior every single day. And what I say to people is write down your failure narrative. Write it down. I give exercise in the book on how to do it. And then the big question is, how is that narrative affecting your behavior now? Maybe it helps you understand why you can't confront people. Maybe this business about needing to assemble a team that complements your skills, why can't you do it? You know you need to do it. Why can't you do it? Well, the truth is you may have found in the past you feel insecure, or maybe you're afraid to admit you can't do something because you're going to feel stupid, and you hate feeling stupid because you grew up feeling stupid. Or, you know, there could be a million reasons, but what I find is the failure narrative usually is a nice way of saying the impediments to matching your strengths and weaknesses with your passions and matching those with a job so you can make a greater impact. It's what holds you back, and it's not all that rational much of the time. And when you start thinking about it, you start to laugh about it because you realize it is kind of funny because we know we're all doing it.
Yes. And you begin to shine the light on it. And you know what? It's just not as intimidating as it used to be.
It's not. And what I try to get people to do in a group or in a class is tell their failure narrative or talk about it to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And their reaction is always the same. Wow. Doesn't sound so bad once I explained it.
Yes.
And in fact, I realized everybody's got one. I'm not the only one. Everybody is struggling with this, and it's not so bad. And maybe it's okay to admit it and address it.
Well, listen, Robert, thank you for taking the time to join us. Again, this is Robert Kaplan, author of What You're Really Meant to Do, A Roadmap for Reaching Your Unique Potential. Thank you for taking the time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
Take care. We want to thank Robert Kaplan again for taking the time to join us here on the podcast. And remember to follow us on Twitter at Entree Leadership or email me your questions at podcasts@entreeleadership.com. Stay plugged into this Entree Leadership stuff. Keep learning and keep leading. Remember, grow yourself, grow your team, and grow your profits.